It wasn't my finger saying, oh, this is something comfortable. Hey, brain, make this acceptable to non-bassists. It was my sort of musical self saying, like, this is what I'm wanting to hear. Go figure out how to do it.
Welcome to episode 120 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. All right, what's up, folks? What's up, folks? There's been a little delay since the last episode, a little break that was unintentional. That was definitely unintentional. I had a hard drive crash again. For regular listeners, you might remember that that happened a few years ago. I had a hard drive crash, and you'd think I'd learn from my mistakes a little bit better than I did. That being said, I do have everything backed up, right? The rule of thumb kind of is to have everything in three places. Right, cats who are doing home sessions, all that, you guys know. You have everything in so many places so that this isn't an issue. I hadn't backed up in a little while. I guess it's a good problem to have, which is like, you know, a lot of PR companies are hitting me up and they want me to do these different interviews and things with their guests, their clients that are bass players. And some of the bass players I had reached out to personally, upcoming episodes, They were on the drive. They got, you know, lost. For this one with Dr. Matt Hare, next week's episode with Catherine Schulmeister, Dark Oles, Reggie Hamilton, Tom Kennedy. All right, so I had a bunch kind of pre-recorded waiting to come out, and had to take the drive to a guy to get him to recover the data. Everything's recovered. And now it's time to not ever have this happen again. Last time the drive crashed, most of it got recovered. There was an interview with Nicole Rowe, bassist who is now with Incubus. That one didn't make the cut. That one didn't survive. But we're back. We're back. The podcast is back. We'll be coming at you every Wednesday. What's news? Been putting the final touches on the Bass Shed Academy studio. Had Mr. Jerry Jamonta over earlier this week. We're shooting some videos for the transcription book that's coming out. It's a transcription book that Jerry Jamonta and I are putting out. Jerry and I are shooting some videos about the transcriptions. So he'll talk about the bass line. He'll talk about what the recording sessions were like, as he remembers it, and just some things about working with these different artists. I mean, Jerry and I have talked through a lot of this stuff beforehand, and still, when we were shooting the videos, some things he talked about I didn't even know. So I hope you all get a chance to check that out. The wisdom of Mr. Jerry Jamonta. That book was supposed to come out, like it was slated to come out on March 22nd, which was a few days ago. Not because it was his birthday, coincidentally, you know, I was looking at the calendar. I'm like, okay, dude, I think I can get it together, you know, by March 22nd. He's like, oh man, that's my birthday. I'm like, oh, that's sick. Okay, then let's definitely aim for that. So that was the aim for the book. We didn't make it. It took, you know, the whole project kind of took some turns, but we're still working on it. He's coming back over later this week. We're going to shoot some more videos to get more of the behind the scenes information from Jerry himself about these transcriptions. So, you can learn more about the book at thebassshedacademy.org. LemurMusic.com. Everything you need for the double bass can be found at LemurMusic.com. Shop their inventory of sheet music, bows, rosin, basses, bass accessories, etc. LemurMusic.com. Use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off. So, again, LemurMusic.com. Everything you need for the double bass. Use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off. Folks, if you are enjoying the Bass Shed podcast, help me keep the lights on at the studio here. help me keep the lights on and support the show. There's a link in the description of this episode and all episodes that'll give you more information about that. I recently learned that the Bass Shed podcast has grown to be in the top 5% of all podcasts globally, which, I don't know, there's over like 3.2 million podcasts or something. I feel like there's at least a million of them that are just true crime, right? Just like right off the bat, like easy million that are just true crime. But thank you to all the listeners and for checking out the show and continuing to check out the show. And I humbly ask that if you are enjoying the show, please consider supporting it to keep the lights on, and so we can continue bringing you great interviews with great bass players from around the world. All right, on the episode, my guest is Dr. Matt Hare. Dr. Matt Hare is a double bassist, composer, and educator based in Southern California. Dr. Hare is the principal bassist of the Mozart Classical Orchestra and the Long Beach Ballet. Dr. Hare is also the teacher at the University of Southern California, Irvine, UCI. In addition to mentoring the bass studio at UCI, he is a regular clinician at high schools in the area. Dr. Hare is also the director of Bass Ford, a nonprofit that hosts bass events around Southern California. I got hip to Dr. Hare after I learned of his performance that was held on March 17th, of where he was going to be playing the world-famous Carr Koussevitzky bass. I actually got the chance to stop into the rehearsal, the first rehearsal he was doing for that concert. I got to hear him perform some of the repertoire. I got to hear the bass. It was an honor. I got to play the bass. You can see that little clip. We did shoot a video of that. You can see that little clip on YouTube. There's a link in the show notes here of this episode. Coming up on April 5th, Dr. Hare will present a faculty recital on the Carr Koussevitzky bass at the University of Southern California, Irvine. The program features work composed by, commissioned by, or dedicated to Koussevitzky. The conversation here with Dr. Hare is describing a piece of music that he sent me a video to. The title of the piece is Barber 1013. I have a link to that video, again, in the show notes. So please stop by and check out all those videos. I highly recommend checking them out. And this was a fantastic talk with Dr. Matt Hare. Here it is. Here it is, my conversation with double bassist, composer, educator, and principal bassist of the Mozart Classical Orchestra and the Long Beach Ballet, Dr. Matt Hare.
So how are you? Do any of your guests ask about you?
Sometimes. Man, I checked out the link you sent. That's killing. That was great.
Cool. I'm glad to hear it.
The title of it is Barber?
Yeah. The title of it is Barber 1013. And
I thought that was the date, actually, that it was like recorded or something.
No, it's kind of misleading. So that piece, it started out, it was just like this limbering exercise, and then it took a wrong turn, but sounded really cool. And it started to develop, and it kind of reminded me of English string music, like Vaughan Williams or Barber. Mm-hmm. And then it also reminded me of maybe like a prelude to one of the cello suites.
Yeah, I definitely heard that quality. Yeah.
Yeah. So the cello suites, the numbering stops at 10, 12. So it's sort of like a punchline. Like, what do you get if a bassist tuned like a cellist is playing a piece by Barber who's pretending to be Bach? and the answer is Barber 1013. So
yeah. That's hilarious. What was your tuning on that?
So I'm tuned in fifths. So like, okay, a contra cello or a contra contra viola.
So what's your lowest sounding pitch then?
Right. So the fattest string is like a C extension C.
Okay.
And then the next string number three, is a G. Like I think we can speak frets. Like, you know,
yeah.
E string three is my string number three. D is always D. Don't, if you panic, go to string number two. It's always D. And then string number one is like the A on the G string fret two.
Okay. Yeah. So where do you get the strings for that? Are those solo strings tuned in fifths?
Yeah. So, let's see. So, again, working from the bottom, if you were to get the lowest string from a five string set, you can, you know, do the E, or I'm sorry, do the C. String number four is a C from a five string set.
Yeah.
The G can be tricky. Some people take an F sharp from a solo set, like string number four, which we always think is E, but is in fact tuned to F sharp. And some people bring it up to G. Okay. And some other people will get like a stark A and flab it down to G.
Okay.
And then D is D. And then string number one is from a solo set. And, you know, there are a couple manufacturers. Obligato makes a fifth set.
Okay.
Spiracore makes a fifth set. They call it a Red Mitchell set. And I think some other people do too. I know I had a set from...
Did Red Mitchell tune in fifth?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Like I've checked him out a lot listening, but I didn't really get that deep into his thing. I didn't know that, actually. That's fascinating.
Yeah, there are some great stories about him. Let's see. Man, I didn't bone up on this, so I hope it's all right. That's all right. I hope it's all right. My understanding is at a certain point, he wanted to do like a piccolo bass thing.
Okay.
And he grabbed a cello and tuned it in fourths and said, this sucks.
Yeah.
Like all the magic went out of it. And it immediately struck him, like, I wonder if my bass is like this, and if I tuned it in fifths, if it would unlock, you know, right, the reverse of how this cello. Yeah, so he fooled around with it a little bit, and then I think legend has it, he went to, like, some motel in Oceanside for a long weekend and just relearned everything.
Jeez, that is a long weekend. That is a very long weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
So a little bit more, what bass were you playing in that video? And is that video out in the world? Like, I'm talking about this visual thing on an audio only.
Right.
Is that video released into the wild?
Maybe. I'll have to double check. I'm going to tell you straight out, I can be shy with social media. I remember a time where, like, man, if I was at karate looking at Facebook, I was like, oh, I should be practicing. And then if I was at a gig between, I'd see some dad doing something like, oh, I'm a terrible dad. And this guy has that gig. So I, you know, very, very measured increments, and I'm putting myself out there. I'm more fragile than I thought, but let's do this. I know you're a professional. I bet you do show notes. So sure. We'll make sure it's available for okay. Listeners so they can see.
Yeah. Great.
So yeah, the bass. That bass is unusual, and I sometimes joke that I just drive that bass around for people to hear it.
I mean, it sounded gorgeous. I didn't even want to take a guess at the year, but what do you know the year and luthier?
I don't. There's no label inside. So. Again, so theater of the mind. It's a cornerless pear-shaped bass.
Yeah.
And it looks a little small, but I'm a little big. I was
curious, actually. Like, in that video, there's kind of a downward firing camera angle. So I didn't know if it was the camera angle, but then at the end when you stood up with it, I'm like, that kind of looks like a 5/8 or something.
Yeah, yeah. So there's no label. I don't. All I know is a bunch of hearsay and cool stories about.
Oh, nice. Bring the cool stories.
Let's see. So the instrument itself, the string length is pretty traditional. It's 41 5/8. Mm-hmm. The widest part of the bottom is a little under 27 inches, which again is pretty traditional. But it's pear shaped, so it's almost like an upside down keyhole, like the. Yeah. It doesn't really have inner bouts.
Right.
And then the upper shoulders are only like 15 or 16 inches across. So if you're only seeing like the upper two thirds, it looks really small, especially when I'm playing it. but it makes it super comfortable. Like, without really stretching or leaning, I can... With my left hand, I can lean over and touch the bridge. Like, I can get all the way over there. Yeah. Plus, I'm sitting And you can see it in the video. I sit on a chair. I think a cellist in the San Diego Symphony made it. So it's almost like a kitchen chair, but the legs are adjustable.
Oh, okay.
So the legs are maybe like 3 or 4 inches taller than a kitchen chair. So I can sit with both my feet flat on the floor. You know, I would go to these ISB conventions and I'd see like what do you call them? Like the master's division bassists. And they would have like this left kind of hump. And then I would see them 2 years later and it would be higher. Yeah. I'd see them 2 years later, it'd be higher. And I was like, oh, and then I met like an Alexander Technique person. And I was like, let's get in front of this. Please help me.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And again, as a tall guy, I was, you know, sometimes music stands aren't high or you're sharing and then the end pins all the way out. And I was like, let's just take 10 inches off at everything.
How tall are you?
Anymore, I think 6'3.5".
Okay.
At the end of this week, I'm probably 6'1". It's been a long week.
Yeah. Right. What day is today? Today's Friday. Yeah, it's been a long week.
Yeah, but it's like a Saturday on a Friday. Like my kid's out because of the President's Day stuff. So
I thought that was Monday.
It's both for my kid's district. It's going to
really?
Be.
They acknowledge it on the Friday and the Monday?
Yeah, it's that's not how we did it when I was a kid.
No, but. same. I didn't even know if I got it off, but maybe I did. So you wrote the piece, but you described it as a kind of an exercise gone wrong. What was the what was the inspiration for it?
Yeah, when at that period I was experimenting a lot with texture. I was in a funny place because when you're tuned in fifths, you're kind of closer to what cellos and violas do. But in a way, you cannot. I felt like I was a little bit further than what most bassists were doing. There's some stuff that's off the table, like let's say like the Hindemith Sonata and a lot of the ultra fancy Bottesini. It's just not going to work in fifths. But at the same time, when I was playing with that tuning initially, I had kind of moved away from some of that stuff. So there was a little bit of an expat vibe.
Okay.
And I started to look and listen to a lot more piano music because with bass, with a stringed instrument, you got it's almost like four little instruments in tandem. And for instance, like you could play the open G and then you could go to the D string fret 5 and play that G or the A string fret 10. Or if you're weird enough, you could go up to fret 15 and play that same G on the E string. But on the piano, like a pitch is a singularity, like middle C is middle C.
Right.
And you could play it with, you know, 10 different fingers, but it's right there. And I started to really think about things like Sunken Cathedral, where you've got like this
Debussy.
Yeah. So you've got this cloud of notes that's making the, that's establishing the harmony. But then somehow the pianist has to poke out a melody from within that cloud. So they don't have the advantage of, you know, sometimes Bach does like a pedal thing. Right. Where he's got like he's like, here's the pedal. It's on this string. Melodic stuff is happening over here. But the piano, because of the singularities, it's like they've got to figure out how to, through articulation, make the melody stand out from that cloud. And I was like, why don't we do that? We just put stuff in G and then do a bunch of harmonics. So, if you go back and listen to Barber 1013, like there's a very simple motive that I keep trying to make poke out from the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, the first two notes that you hear, like the bum bum, bum bum, and as that cloud moves around to different tonalities, that thing keeps poking out. So, at that time there was a lot of daydreaming what playing a piano must be like, and then figuring out how to fake that on a not fourth tuning.
So, because kind of the impetus came from a musical inspiration. Excuse me. Right. Thinking about the piano and melodies and how to translate a lot of that information to a bass strung like a cello.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Because it's got an interesting feel to it. It sounds like, you know, like the dawn of a new day, and it kind of sounds like the day is coming alive as the sun comes up. And there's like this like fresh energy, you know, in the very beginning of it all, this fresh energy, and like everything's kind of waking up and like sprightly, and you know, the dawn of a new morning kind of feel. And I feel like there's a strong visual that can be attached to it if someone lets their imagination goes there.
Write all that down and send it to me and sign it. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I thought it was great. Yeah.
When I write, I like economy of material, and I like having sort of presenting a compact, memorable idea that can sprout a bunch of different ways.
Sure.
I think we've all heard music or maybe a solo where someone just, like, it's just all over the place. It's just like watching a clown pull an endless scarf out of their mouth. How are we going to tie this back together?
That's a great analogy.
So, yeah, when somebody, I'm trying to do less with more, or at least have a little thing that can develop, germinate, mutate a bunch of different ways.
What have you written? I mean, you've written other pieces, I'm assuming. Well, are those released into the wild? Are those out there somewhere?
There's another piece which is from the same period and has a lot of the same motivation as far as like texture and piano impersonation. And it goes back to something a composition teacher told me way back in school. We were talking about theme and variations, and there are a lot of theme and variations where the variations are kind of superficial. Like there's a triplet-y variation, or maybe one variation that's in the parallel minor, and rarely does it get more substantial. And he said, "Like, well, have you ever thought about variations in search of a theme?" And it made me think about how could you take a theme and what sorts of essential qualities can you vary or alter? And then at the end of that variation, kind of reset it and go to another supposedly fundamental thing and shift around. So the name of that is theme and invariance, where I'm trying to focus on not looking for things to change, but how little can I keep the same and suggest that this is the same thing when so much else is altered?
This is fascinating, because the first thing, as you're explaining it, the first thing that comes to mind is just a rhythmic displacement. You can keep the same group of notes in the same order, you know, with the same note durations for your melody and your theme, but you could just displace it rhythmically, and then that's the variant. What were some tools you used for variation to still maintain the integrity of the initial theme?
Well, sometimes I would take a part of the melody and augment it and add some rhythmic elements to that. At one point, the theme is upside down and done in stretto. Okay. So you hear it on the top string and the last note sustains, and then I'm able to play the melody on the second string with my thumb. So you get, you know, that kind of two voice thing happening.
Yeah.
There's one variation where part of the melody shows up in like a spiccato bariolage. I feel bad I didn't dress up and have my fiddle out. this is cool. You know, I don't listen to a lot of podcasts, but I always feel dirty when it's just some dude like shilling an event, you know. Where's the shameless plug? This, this is a really cool, like, this rabbit hole, let's go.
Yeah, let's do it. On the Barber 1013, back to that piece.
Yeah.
There's a lot of demanding technique with the bow that was required for that piece. And also demanding technique for the left hand with more modern, quote unquote, progressive. I mean, you had your thumb way back on the fingerboard at some sections. Like, there was some pretty, I don't know, you would know better than me the kind of where that system comes from. That really, like, having the thumb kind of that far back, I got hip to through the Petrarchy book. So, like, in my mind, that's how, when I see that happening, Petrarchy comes to mind. But, so, I mean, there was a lot of that. You had it back. If we're talking about on the G string, maybe around a C sharp or D, maybe even further back than the C sharp, it was pretty far back there. So there's a lot of progressive technique and demanding technique. Is that also the case in this piece you're speaking of with the variants?
In theme and in variants, there's a place where it goes back even further. I'm going to say, like, fret two.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, so let's see, man.
Man, how that what's the shoulder position like to, or I mean, what kind of angle is the bass on if you're sitting to get the thumb over the fingerboard that far back?
I'm glad we have our cameras on, because you've got, it almost looks like your thumb is in your ear with the upside down moose antler. I'm like, oh man, I hope I don't do it like that. So my bass is probably at about a 45 degree angle. And I'm using a, I've got a Labarie hole. So the end pin is going almost straight down. And
the bass is on the angle?
Yeah. So okay. The bass, but because of the bass is angled, the little wooden nub, it's super small. You know, it's barely coming out at all. Franco's book, Simplified Higher Technique, is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's really rigorous and codifies everything. I'm going to pause this for a moment and just zoom out to like fourths and fifths. So I just want to say, in case there are fourths players that haven't turned this off yet, that
the electric players gave up a long time ago. Like, well, we're not talking about Bootsy Collins. I'm out.
Right. Wait, I've got a bongo stealth five string. So I teach at the University of California, Irvine, and I've got a body of rep in fourths that I only do in fourths that I work my students through. Mm-hmm. And early on, what I did, kind of by accident, do you remember there was some software that would only work when a proprietary USB key was in, like the old Pro Tools? You know what I mean? It was like,
you had to have the iLock or the key lock or something.
Yeah,
I remember
So what I did for probably the first 10 years of going back and forth, fourths and fifths, was I would only play, well, I needed to play fifth sitting to get low thumb. And then for fourths, I would stand, and I didn't realize I was doing it until one day I tried to sit with a fourth bass and my brain booted up wrong. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I could use my posture to get me in the right mental tuning.
Okay.
So I try to just play sitting fifths.
Right. You create this kind of trigger for yourself. Like, when you're sitting, brain goes to fifths.
Exactly. Legs straight.
Yeah.
EADG. Legs bent. CGDA. So there's a master class coming up in March. And when people come to that, they will see students playing in fourths, and I'll be teaching them in fourths. So, but then if I'm out, like gigging or freelancing or doing some recital music, I'm usually in fifths, and I usually keep my mouth shut about it. Cause there's some bassists that, just don't like the idea at all. So, especially at the beginning, I would try to just show up, play it all down. And if nobody said anything, it would be like wild success.
Well, how does the fifths, you play fourths when you play principal?
No. So for instance, with Long Beach Ballet, where I'm principal, I play in fifths. You know, the funniest thing is, so the first year I did fifths, what I did was I took the summer off and I just did scales and arpeggios and fifths. And I've taught like string methods at the college level. So I understand like how fifths work, and I've had, mm-hmm. you know, some cello, and I thought, all right, I'm going to do this first season in fifths, and I'm not going to say anything, and I'll tune away from people so they don't like hear me tuning. and if nobody, you know, if I get through the first year, then, you know, I think I'll be all right. So I, in that first year, you know, like 40, 42 weeks of playing, only two people noticed something. One was a bassist who was like, "Do you have a low C?" And I was like, "Yes." Partial truth. Like, yes, my bottom string is C. Let's get back to work. And then the other time, I was playing like a requiem or something. So it was choir and small orchestra, and it was only two bassists, me and someone else. And the bassist's wife was in the audience, and she was a violist. And she came over at intermission. She was like, "I don't know what's going on. It sounds good. I don't know what's going on here."
You got a whistleblower? She's exposing the whole thing.
Because when my stand partner would play F sharp on the E string, fret 2, mm-hmm. I'd be on my fourth string at fret 6.
Right.
But usually the people I'm playing with, like our bows are always going in the same direction. And the string crossings, if anything, they're the same or only like one scale step off. So if someone's, you know, hopefully they're looking at the music, the conductor, and then maybe me peripherally, you know, if I'm on their left or right. But I was really surprised the first year, like very few people noticed.
Hmm.
And I've had some bassists, some LA bassists say like, that doesn't sound, I don't know if you're going to win like a big job. That doesn't sound what I'm expecting. But then at gigs, I've had cellists turn around and be like, "I've been waiting for a bass to sound like that."
Really?
Because I'm so used to basses that sound like they've got like bronchitis, like these, you know, this that really big beer garden stroke. That roof, roof.
Yeah.
Beer which garden. I can kind of do, but it's a little it's a little clearer when I do that in fifths. So anyway, I just wanted to throw out that I do fourths, but a lot of the stuff, a lot of my personal projects are in fifths for a couple different reasons.
Okay. How long ago did you make that shift?
How
long has it been since you've been doing the fourths and fifths setups?
Right. So I first tried it around 2000 when I was at the University of Iowa studying with Diana Gannett. It was spring break. I decided I would tune that way because I had nowhere to go.
I gotta hit pause on the conversation. This is your spring break story? Like right. Everybody else goes out to Havasu or down to Miami. They want to go clubbing and partying, and you're like, I'm gonna experiment with the double bass and fifths.
Right. MTV, yeah. Spring break. Yeah, tuned in fifths. So I did that, and Diana was like, you know, I've had students do this and I support this. You know, you should decide whether you want to continue or not. And I thought, you know, for me to really pick Diana's brain clean while I'm here, I should probably stay in fourths.
Mm-hmm.
So I stuck in fourths. And then when I first got to California, I was like, maybe this would be a good time. But at that time, I was, you know, trying to break into the scene and develop, build a private studio. And I didn't want like any missteps or hesitations when I'm, you know, playing with someone or for someone. So the third time, the time that really stuck, I want to say it was around 2009 or 2010. And at that point, I felt pretty settled into Orange County. I had made as much money teaching and playing recitals and a concerto or two than I had gigging around. I hadn't broken into, like I had subbed with San Diego Symphony, but not, you know, won any type of contract. Plus that particular season was rough. Indianapolis Symphony got locked out. Minnesota got locked out. Chicago was, they were either on strike or locked out. I think San Francisco had a week where they weren't open. And so I just felt like, am I holding on to this because of a job in, you know, a potentially landlocked part of the country where, mm-hmm. you know, I'd be making less than I'm making in California with this weird piecemeal thing that I've put together. So I felt like, what have I got to lose? And that's when I realized that also, and you have students, I'm sure you have a sequence of student rep that you do pretty often that you work people through. And it occurred to me that if I take that sequence of rep and kind of lock it off in fourths, then I could do this other stuff in fifths when I'm mm-hmm. out and about on town. So the long answer to your question is I think it's been since like 2009 or 2010 that I've been in fifths.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have students wanting to investigate that and get into it, or at least check it out? Have you had some students that like have taken the same passion for it that you have?
So at one point, kind of early on, I had two. One was a student. It's kind of funny. It was so Tammy, who owns Lemur, mm-hmm. she called me up and she's like, there's this kid who's way into music. He's played cello for like a year or two. And they said like, hey, you're tall, go play this bass and learn from this other kid who just learned 6 months ago. And he was doing okay, but he was struggling. And I thought, you know, I approached the parents and I said, I want to try this crazy thing where Tammy loaned us a bass and gave us a used set of strings, fifth strings. And I said, I will teach you for free just to see where this goes. Okay. If I can take your, you know, the cello knowledge that you have and see if we can, you know, bring it over to bass. And we did that and it was going pretty well. And then his orchestra teacher called me and he's like, what do you think you're doing to this kid? And I was like, I thought I was helping, but yeah, I guess I'm not. Sorry. And I talked to the parents. I'm like, you know, this is your teacher. He's in charge of your grades. You know, you're going to have music. Yeah. So I think we shifted over to fourths. That kid eventually went to NYU film school and is like making documentaries somewhere.
That's cool.
And still doing music, like side project indie release stuff.
We'll be back right after this.
Hi, this is Jerry Jamont. I want to tell you about my upcoming book of bass transcriptions, JJ's Jukebox Volume 1. This is a collection of over 15 of my bass lines in standard notation and tablature. They are accurately done here by Ryan Roberts of the Bass Shed Academy. Each transcription is accompanied by a video where I talk about what was happening during the recording session, how I got involved, and how I approach each song. Stop by the BassShedAcademy.org to learn more about my book of transcriptions, JJ's Jukebox Volume 1, and purchase a signed copy of my memoirs, Make It Happen.
Excellent, sir.
All this talk of tuning in fifths and playing like a cello, I do want to reference, you play German bow, which is, you know, more rare in LA or Southern California than French. Most people I've seen around play French. German's the rare one. I play German. That's why I'm so aware that it's rare. But how this young student who's getting into the fifths, were they French or
German? I think he was French because of the cello background.
Right.
He felt more comfortable just going over to French. And when I started bass originally, my teacher had me on German. And I, strangely enough, I was aware of Edgar Meyer before I started bass.
Okay.
So I was pushing,
to be aware of.
Yeah. And got a funny story about that. But so almost immediately I was like, I want to play French. So after maybe like a year and a half, I moved to French and did French for maybe 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then when I started studying with David Murray, I moved back to German. So
okay.
I feel pretty comfortable on French. Not all my bouncing stuff is up to snuff, but
on French,
yeah. on French, yeah.
Huh. That it actually seems like it would be. I have like zero French technique, but it seems like it would be easier on French, just because of the posture on the overhand grip for all the off string stuff.
So maybe I'll. So when I was studying with Diana at Iowa, we had every now and then she would call switch day. So we would have studio class. So there were like 15 bases and we'd walk in and get ready to play our group exercise. And she'd be like, switch day. So that meant if you stood, you had to sit. And that if you did French, you had to do German, you know?
Okay.
Because I think there are certain things that kind of happen a little more readily on French and then other things that kind of happen on German. And I remember there was this particular, actually like a spiccato barriolage, that kind of rolling bouncing thing. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of trouble with it on German. And then one day it sort of happened almost accidentally on French. And it was one of these, it was sort of like a bicycle epiphany. Like you can talk all about how to ride a bike and, you know, but you fall over and you fall over and fall over. But then there's that one moment where you go like 15 feet without crashing and you're like, yeah. Oh, this is how it is. And then, you know, you turn that into 20 feet and 25 feet. So yeah, my spiccato breakthrough actually was on French. But the funny thing was once I felt it on French, I was able to go over and grab my German bow and then just make it happen.
Okay. It's just a lot more natural to translate it.
Yeah. There's sort of an equation of sort of speed and length. And I like to think of my bow as having like X and Y speed. So almost like graphing. So the side to side, like just playing an open string is like the X action of the bow.
Okay.
And then the Y, the up and down, the one that controls what string you're on, I've always thought of that as Y.
So you're thinking like the horizontal axis as X.
Yes.
And that would control that's not what string you're on. That's the pitch. Or that's the speed?
That's what we usually think of as speed, just how fast the hair is crossing the string.
Yeah, okay.
And then the Y speed sort of controls how quickly you get to the other strings. So I see a lot of people when they want to do, let's see, a four string string cross slurred, they're pulling the bow sideways at the same speed that they're lifting their arm.
Right.
And they potentially waste a lot of bow. The bow sort of like rides the clutch between the strings.
Sure.
And the bass bow is shorter than the violin bow. And the violin bridge is just a little bit bigger than the space between each of our strings. So it's almost like, in effect, the violin bow is four times as long compared to how close the strings are. So we have to be like really frugal with our bows. So I'll try to convince my students that they can, for instance, spiccato barriolage, when I do it, my bow is almost, if I had a sparkler instead of a bow, it's almost making a lowercase J in the air. Mm-hmm. It's almost an entirely up and down motion, and there's just a tiny little hook at the bottom. Because most people start it, they're trying to make almost like a quarter circle because their X and Y speed are the same.
That's fascinating. I've never heard, when I think about like an X and Y axis with the bow, X would be, you know, the horizontal, and Y would be like the distance from the end of the fingerboard to the bridge.
Right.
Like I would think about it as that plane, but you're thinking it as two different planes in relation to speed. So kind of giving another dimension to speed.
Yeah, that bow, bridge proximity, like how near or far the bow is from the bridge. Diana always called point of contact.
Mm-hmm.
And we would talk about, so there, that whole X speed, like if you play kind of sul tasto over near the fingerboard, the bow spends pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And then the closer and closer you get to the bridge, yeah, the sound gets brighter, but the bow also burns a lot slower.
Right.
And in Diana's method book, she'll talk about being, you know, like an inch from the bridge and getting, you know, almost 20 seconds from frog to tip. And it's really hard to control. It's almost like, I don't know if I'd ever play like that, but it's almost like adversity training. Like, it's nice to have that in your back pocket.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about some events you got coming up.
Yeah. So, so it's 2024. It's the 150th anniversary of Koussevitzky's birth. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to have the Carr Koussevitzky base for a couple of weeks. This is the base. This was Koussevitzky's personal instrument. And then later on, Koussevitzky's widow saw a young Gary Carr play and got in touch with him and just gave him the instrument. Wow. And then he concertized with it for decades. And then when he retired, I think the second time, he gave the bass to the International Society of Bassists, the ISB. And now the bass is, it's on sort of a perpetual loan. I think it's in, it was just with, Aaron. Oh, what is his, last name? He's over at the, Guneri shop in, Michigan. A couple of different players have sort of that borrowed it. It's like home base at Aaron's shop, and different people did things. And I think they had it at the big Texas Music Educators Convention recently. And then I'll get it in about 4 weeks. And there are a couple of things that are going to happen here in Orange County. On March 17th, there's going to be a masterclass in Santa Ana, and it's going to be sponsored by South Coast Symphony, Lemur Music, G&L, Guitars and Basses, and Zimmerman Publications. And the way it's going to work is we're going to have two students. One's a high school student, one's a college student. And one's going to play Chanson Triste by Koussevitzky on the Koussevitzky bass. And then I'll coach them a little bit. And Marina Pakowski, incredible pianist and used to be essentially staff accompanist at the ISB convention. She's going to be there. And she's going to have some input with the students too. So the high school student's going to play Chanson Triste on the Koussevitzky bass. And then the college student's going to play some of the Koussevitzky concerto on the Koussevitzky bass. And then we'll have a short intermission. And then I'll play about a 22-minute program with Marina. And I'll actually do the two pieces we talked about. I'll do the Barber 1013 and the theme and invariants. So it's March 17, 3 p.m., Santa Ana. It's $25, but students are free with ID. And in the show notes, we'll have the RSVP number because it's at a fantastic private home on Skyline Drive. It looks out on all of Orange County. And it's a big home, but it is I think it seats about 50. So it's kind of capped.
Wow. So are you tuning the Koussevitzky bass in fifth? For those, or you bring in another bass tuned in fifths and leaving Koussevitzky in fourth?
Well, for this event, the Koussevitzky bass will be, for the first half, for the Koussevitzky stuff, it's going to be in fourth. So it's going to be in orchestra tuning. The first string is going to be a Stark A from a solo set, which we can drop to G without it being too flabby. And then when I play it on the second half, it'll be in fifths. So string number three is a Stark A, which will be dropped to G. And then the bottom string, it's really not used all that much because it's recital-y stuff. People will, you will see students play the Koussevitzky bass in orchestra tuning at that event. On March 27, I'm going to do a short program at Santa Ana High School. So we've got some high school outreach. On April 3rd, I'm going to do that same abbreviated program at Santa Ana College. And then on April 5, I'm going to do my faculty recital at UCI. And then on April 6th, the base, we're going to have an open house at Lemur at 1 p.m. I'm hoping you'll be there. I'll be there.
Yeah, I was just down there teaching on Wednesday, and we were talking about that. Still working out some time. I mean, When I was down there talking to her about it, we were working out times. I'm also going to be back in Phoenix because that exact day is my parents' 50th wedding anniversary.
Oh, my gosh.
So we're definitely doing that. I got to make sure that they want to do it on the day. You know, me, my brother, and my sister are putting together that party for them. But making sure that they want to do it on that day. And that wins. So whatever they want to do, you know.
Right.
I also got called for a gig that day that I'm like, dude, I don't know if I can go to Seattle. I gotta do this. Yeah. So
let's go play Koussevitzky for your parents.
And they would love it. I would have to explain who Koussevitzky is, remind them both that, like, hey, this is the big version, this is the double bass. You guys remember seeing me with that in college?
Oh man, that's fantastic. 50 years.
I know. It's incredibly impressive.
I'm hoping Lemur's still committed to that date.
Yeah, they are. We did, because you and I had talked about some ideas about maybe seeing if we could incorporate Gary Carr somehow. Right. You know, none of that. I'm not saying he's going to fly in or even do any kind of Zoom thing. We're still sorting that out. Yeah. But that would be very cool to hear him talk about the bass and all that, you know, because the bass will be on show at Lemur. People can come check it out and. Right. Probably not so play it, but they can come. I don't know how she wants to run that.
Yeah. What she and I talked about was April 8th through 12th. The instrument will be at Lemur, and you can, you know, make an appointment to come down and either Chris Hornung of Zimmerman Publications or Marlin or me or maybe you, if it's a Wednesday, can sort of exhibit the bass. So, yeah, the bass will be down here. For all these things. The April 5th recital, my faculty recital at UCI, I've programmed it around Koussevitzky, the champion of new music, because, you know, we bassists, we think of Koussevitzky and we're like, oh yeah, bass guy. But most other musicians, when they hear Koussevitzky, they're like, oh, the conductor of Boston Symphony, the guy who established Tanglewood, the guy who established the Koussevitzky Foundation that commissioned things from Bartok and Copland and Bernstein and William Schumann. And is that foundation is still commissioning new works. And he mentored young Leonard Bernstein. Mm-hmm. So my program, instead of just doing the five Koussevitzky things on the Koussevitzky bass, I've broadened it. I'm going to do a little bit of my stuff. I've found two Bernstein pieces that are dedicated to Sergei Koussevitzky and Nadia, and I've transcribed them for bass. I'm going to do Crumb Madrigal's Book One, which is for bass, soprano, and vibraphone.
Oh, wow.
And that was it was commissioned by the Koussevitzky Foundation, and it's dedicated to Koussevitzky. And then I teamed up with a guy named Rob Boise, who's a composer in New York, and he's got a podcast and a composer's forum, and he does this project that he calls 15 Minutes of Fame. So he and I came up with a call for compositions, and the rules were, like, it's got to be for unaccompanied bass and fifths, and it's got to be a minute long, and it's got to be dedicated to Koussevitzky. And then all of these submissions came through. The deadline was in November. And for the last couple months, I've been reading through dozens of one-minute compositions. And I've picked the top 15. So that's 15 minutes of fame, the 15 one-minute pieces. So the premiere will be at the April 5th thing.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah, I'm trying to make it about, like, the complete Koussevitzky new music guy.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, and I'll play Chanson Triste and maybe another Koussevitzky piece.
For those that may not be aware of all what you spoke about, the five Koussevitzky pieces, what are the five Koussevitzky pieces for people that, you know, maybe this is the first time they're learning about them?
Yes, thank you. So there are four short kind of salon pieces. There's Chanson Triste, Andante, Humoresque, and Waltz Miniature. And those are all maybe like around 4 minutes or so. And they're usually done bass and piano. And then there's a concerto, a three movement concerto. And all of this stuff, all five pieces are in like a very like late romantic style, like very tonal, a lot of like chromatic neighboring tones. And they are, you know, if you're in like a performance major, they are like staples of the rep. When I worked at Lemur, I sometimes joked that that music, when you bought a bass bag, like that music was in the music pouch. already.
That was the stick of gum in the baseball card pack. Everybody got one. Yeah. All right.
Exactly. So they're mainstays of the repertoire. And it's funny to see that Koussevitzky wrote them as a young man when he was a virtuoso bassist, playing full length recitals. And it's funny when you consider his whole life, where he, you know, conducted and commissioned a lot of like very sometimes very angular and modern and progressive works that, you know, the first chapter of his life was, very much in the twilight of romantic music.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I could hear elements of that. There's a nod to that era in your writing. Is that a period within Western European art music, whatever you want to really call all that? Is that a period of time that you really identify with and listen to? You spoke of Debussy earlier. Is that something, a pull you have to that specific period? Or style of composition? More of a maybe modal approach, using some more symmetric scales and stuff instead of the tonal harmony?
Yeah, I feel like when I was in school and learning all of the isms, you know, the serialism and primitivism and, neoclassicism, whenever I had to work in those idioms, sometimes it felt genuine and sometimes it didn't.
Okay.
With the things that I write, I try to almost get kind of a... like schizophrenic with it. I remember at a certain point lamenting like, well, I can't play this bass sonata because it uses these harmonics and I'm in fifths now. And then like, oh, well, I can't play this cello thing because what they do in first position is essentially in my like thumb position, and what would be an open string now has to be engaged by my thumb at the 12th fret. And I was like, I wish somebody would write something like this. And then sort of step out of myself and say like, oh, hello, I'm here to write the very piece that you're lamenting is not around.
Okay. Okay.
is before I started playing that game, I would just come up with, you know, finger noodles, like my fingers would write and it wasn't as cerebral.
Sure.
And it's funny because there's some places in Barber 1013 that were almost, like kind of theoretical. Like, I wonder if I could even do this ostinato with one in thumb and then do that high note that walks down.
I think I might remember the maybe like two thirds of the way through where you're kind of doing almost like a reimagining of the opening theme, but lower on the bass before it gets really lyrical. Because towards the end, it kind of opens up and gets a little bit more dramatic and lyrical. If I remember correctly, but right before that, you're kind of down, upper register-ish around the lower string.
Yeah. There's a place about two thirds in where it almost stops and you get those two notes. You know, that was something that it was the other way. It wasn't my finger saying, oh, this is something comfortable. Hey, brain, make this acceptable to non-bassists. It was my sort of musical self saying like, this is what I'm wanting to hear. Go figure out how to do it.
Yeah. How to make it happen. Cool, man. Dude, we'll be in touch for sure.
This is a lot of fun. Take it easy.
Yo, this is Craig Gash.
What up?
Subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on the Instagram.
Yeah.
The YouTube.
Okay.
Leave us a comment.
Ah, I just stubbed my toe.
All right. That was my talk with That was my talk with Dr. Matt Hare. About his recital coming up on April 5th, I have a link to tickets to that if you are in or around the Southern California area. Also, in the description to this podcast, please stop by. There's a lot of links happening on this one, folks. There's a lot of links. The tickets to the April 5th event are there. Stop by, click on it, and attend if you can. I'm kind of bummed I can't make it. I'll be out of town. It's my parents' 50th wedding anniversary the following day. So I'll be out of town celebrating that with them. If I were here, if I were in town, if I was able to attend, I would absolutely be there. Also, I believe it is the following day on April 6th that the Carr Kusevitzky bass will be at Lemur Music. While I'm down there later this afternoon, I will find out the details about that and be sharing all that information with you. Sign up for the newsletter at the Bass Shed Academy. There'll be more info about all those things coming at you. That's about all I got for this one, folks. I'll catch you on the next one in a minute.